Pascal 6 kilowatt system cost $11,722 after claiming the 26% solar tax credit. The problem is that we have a decreasing amount of the individual solar panels are now only 0.40 cents per watt to 1.10 per watt, depending on the quality of the brands of solar panel. And as of 2020, the federal solar tax credit has reduced of 26%. So, a question to you, Dr. Roy, is: say $11,722 invested, comparing to that what you're paying for your electrical use for 6 kilowatt of power per hour, how many years you need to for that system to pay off?
I could definitely comment on that.
Yeah, feel free, Ray.
Yeah, good evening, Wes. This is Ray, November 2, Zulu Gombuski. If you're going to go for, any kind of money that, gets into the higher bracket, to get everything ready for your home, I don't know what you're running, I don't know what your situation is, but I can tell you that the AGM batteries are definitely well worth the investment. It may cost you an extra couple of bucks up front, but just a little story. I have a very old vintage motorcycle, and I leased it for 7 months outdoors under a cover. I pulled the cover off after 7 months, got on the motorcycle, turned the key, and it started up like a fine-tuned clock. And, if you want to find out more about capacitors, do a little bit of research on the Volova Accutron watch that this was developed for NASA in 1962 by Volova for the space program. It'll give you a really good insight as to what you're dealing with. Their batteries back then were so far more advanced than what we're used to today. And what they led on to what's available to us or not, that it would really just make you take a step back and reconsider your whole plan. And she's at GW back to net.
Well, thank you, Ray. And as I mentioned before, there are electronic quartz watches out there that at least suggest that their power source, rather than being a standard chemical battery, is a supercapacitor that gets charged with a kinematic, a device as you move your wrist. So supercapacitors are alive and well, and the living on a lot of people's wrists these days.
Yeah, the reason I think the lifespan of the panels. Found some information, but since there is a company installing the solar panels, I don't see that information as credible, but they say that the solar panel lasts about 25 to 30 years. I don't know if the battery is storing energy would leave half of that, and then we're talking 0.8% of deterioration, degradation per year. I know that I'm probably paying about $220-$240 for electricity, but I use a lot of electricity, so talking about 12 months, I don't believe it's a good deal for me, especially in New York where sun is not that great.
Well, I am sure that different regions and different technologies get greater or lesser yields. If you are in a desert environment like Nevada and Arizona and such, not that much cloud cover, and especially if you have equipment that adjusts the inclination of the solar panels so that they're more directly hitting the sun, you can squeeze a couple more watts out and it becomes more cost effective. I don't think that solar technology right now is what anyone is expecting for the future. If it doesn't get better, it's not going to do well. But it's not bizarre to expect that the technology will continue to improve, that higher quality designs that are more efficient will be able to be produced at lower prices than they presently are. And, yeah, I don't really know if 20 to 30 years, I think that's a best-case scenario of a very, very easy-going climate where you're not going to have it covered by slush and salt water next to a coastline and other problems and dirt, because you got to clean those things. If they get sooty, the amount of light that goes through will diminish and the efficiency will drop. So it's another technological problem that technology has to solve. I hope they're able to. In the end, everyone keeps on saying that fusion generators are only 20 years away. They've been 20 years away since, I believe, about 1955. So who knows? Maybe someday we'll actually have fusion generators.
Yeah, I'm wondering why thorium wasn't allowed to be used, which cannot blow, and I know what is going on. Interesting.
Thallium is a very interesting fuel. The problem is that although they had some small test reactors, they had not really done the amount of research and development to warrant a fully approved generator for a state, for a large location. And at that time, unfortunately, everyone was so frightened of anything that said radiation that nuclear reactors were taken out of service. So there's very few people, even if you sit there and explain to them why thallium is less risky than other fuel types, you'll get a lot of problems from a lot of people. They don't want these reactors any place near them.
Personally, tell you that I've had more than five people concur that if there were a wind pack on top of every telephone pole, we would have no need for any external fossil solar or gas, oil, fossil fuel power companies whatsoever. It would be great. It would be Tesla's dream.
Okay. Let me drop to see if I have it.
Go ahead.
Yes, that's an interesting thing. I'm not quite sure of the numbers, and you have to also realize that there's a lot of parts of the United States that don't have a lot of poles anyplace. Matter of fact, they're probably better for extracting wind, but nevertheless, I don't know if the math quite works for that. That's a lot of power that you need, and the power capacity of the wind generators, you'd have to not only engineer a lot of those devices, but also efficient storage devices, and that requires a great deal of manufacture and a lot of rechargeable technology, not lead acid, but others require a lot of rare earths like cobalt and such, and I don't know. That's an interesting thing. I would love to see some kind of article where they kind of spell it out and show the math.
Yeah, there was an article in the Scientific Weekly a couple of years ago in regards to that, and it basically said, in brief, what you just stated. It would basically be up to the homeowner to decide, you know, what reserve capacity they might want to have. You know, I'm sure some or all of you have that watch TV have seen the ads for the Generac battery backup system on TV, but that includes the stipulation I mentioned before regarding the your forfeiture of home ownership or lien thereof in their article. But it was a really great article. It's just I think the capacity of what the homeowner needs and the expense thereof, you know, should be left to the homeowner if we were going to go that way, to in fact go ahead and make that investment in their home and leave the rest to the wind pack. But I've driven through the Route 80 from California straight through New York, and they're having great results with some of these windmill fields out that way, and power costs have gone down substantially. N2ZGW, back to net.
Okay, very good, Ray. Once again, I think one of the major problems is that although battery technology slowly improves, it's really fallen behind the other types of technology, certainly Moore's Law. It would be great if there was a Moore's Law for battery technology. So in addition, the problem is that wind devices do not give you a consistent, constant power source. So you have to figure out some way to store the excess, and that's where a lot of problems pop up, because we just don't have the required production and energy density and sustainability in situations like that, as far as I'm aware. Again, people working on batteries all the time. There's a lot of money to be made in new breakthrough battery technology. They're working with supercapacitors, as Wesley has mentioned, all kinds of things. But right now, the energy density, pretty much the highest energy density I'm aware of are things like lithium polymer and lithium ion batteries, which are nice, but you need something more than that. And there's only so much lithium out there.
Agreed, but I digress. Back to net, and to the GW.
And a few words more.
Yes, Wesley, a few words more before we move on to SpaceNet Report.
You mentioned a thorium as the objected by many people. But look, alpha radiation is the least penetrating, can be stopped, absorbed by human hand, and it travels only a few centimeters. But at the same time, thorium-232, which alone makes nearly all natural thorium, is very much common on the Earth. And nobody pays attention if it's there or here, and nobody protests. Third is the most common isotope of thorium in nature. The isotope has the longest life, 1.4 times 10 to 10 of years. Of all isotopes with more than 83 protons, in fact, its lifetime is considerably longer than the age of the Earth. Therefore, thorium-232 belongs to pre-modular nucleates which decay with alpha, decay and create radium 228 and thorium 232. Occasionally decays by spontaneous fission with very low probability, 1.1 times 10 to minus 9 of the percent. So it is not capable of undergoing fission reaction after absorbing thermal neutron. On the other hand, a thorium-232 can be fissioned by fast neutron with energy higher than 1 mega electron volt, which is pretty much common. It's nothing strange about that. And thorium-232 does not meet requirement to fissile material. So nuclear fission chain reaction is not possible because too many neutrons produced by fission of 232 thorium have lower energy than original neutron isotope. Thorium-232 is a key material in the thorium fuel cycle, and we could have excellent, very much safe energy production by using those sources. As far as I know, India was heavily working on it, and they were developing it for so many years, even creating some kind of notion in this area. We fight with Pakistan. Enter here.
Well, I mean, the story is that both India and China are playing around with it. And I, fortunately, I don't know what to make of that, if that's real or imaginary, because, you know, they're usually, those are the two guys who like to play with radioactive things the most. And it's very difficult to really track down real information. Thorium is an interesting substance. It is a radioactive substance. It is not a totally harmless substance. It is basically a heavy metal that's slightly radioactive. And so if it gets into the food supply, it can remain in people's bones and through slow nuclear decay irradiate those bones and increase risk of things. So it's not completely safe. It's in the earth. It's natural. I'll give you that. But unfortunately or fortunately, uranium is also something that's older than the life of the planet and slowly decaying. And it's you know, there are deposits of uranium that are not that deep. People who had problems with radon gas is basically due to uranium in granite and such slowly decaying into radon gas. So it's not harmless. It's not that harmful. It's certainly less harmful than most other radioactive materials. But once you say to someone that it's a nuclear fuel, you got problems with public relations.
I do understand. I do. But if you didn't learn English, it doesn't mean that English doesn't exist. And people cannot communicate with English and communicate and use English for their own needs. By the same token, we're talking about deterioration of the bone. If skin, human skin, is able to stop alpha radiation, it's never going to get to the bone. Let me drop to my two friends. And much upset. The Earth, negative ground, I'm sorry, negative positive, I'm sorry, Earth positive would be our primary source of energy right now. And there isn't a person on the planet that would be without the technology that that man had in mind. And I'm not touting Nikola Tesla. By any means. I'm just saying that through my own studies that the technology that the man had in his brain and the foresight and the progression to, you know, as in the term ham, helping all mankind, was far superior
to very few people, Albert Einstein being included within them.
Okay, Ray, I appreciate what you think, and Wesley is a big fan of Nikola Tesla, and matter of fact, it's weird in that Tesla really hated Einstein. Einstein didn't really think a great deal of him either. Tesla certainly didn't believe in either the theory of special relativity or general relativity. He had decided that he had found particles coming from the sun that were traveling faster than the speed of light in violation of the theory of relativity, and he was going to name it after himself, which was sort of an example of what was going on with Tesla. Tesla, in my humble opinion, was an erratic genius. He got a lot of things right, but no one gets 100% right. And so I think he got a bunch of things wrong. And towards the end, for whatever reason, you'll say probably that he was harassed into, you know, feeding pigeons the last few decades of his life. But the last few decades of his life were not quite as productive as the earlier portions of his life.
The harassment, I would consider it to be more coercion than harassment, but to be as accomplished a scientific mind as Nikola Tesla, and just kind of, you know, for lack of a better phrase, be blown off the way he was, is just despicable in my own personal opinion.
Well, Ray, you know, as I've often, when I tell stories about people in science and histories of them, life is not fair. There have been a lot of people who deserved much more than they got. One of the people that I think, they didn't get what they deserved was Edwin Armstrong, a very brilliant electrical engineer, basically perfected the Odeon tube that its original inventor didn't quite know how it worked. Invented super heterodyning, super regenerative circuits, FM circuits. He basically patented all the necessary devices that run in radios to this very day, except for software-defined radios. And he ended up jumping out of a window in complete despair. He had a lot of litigation problems. His life, unfortunately, was a mess, even though he was a brilliant and highly productive man. So, life ain't fair. One of the people who was instrumental in discovering the double helix of DNA died before Nobel Prizes were given out, and so she missed hers. Life ain't fair.
I'm doing back concur, and you back to net.
Okay, I'm glad we're all in agreement, and I'm sure Wesley could wax poetic on Nikola Tesla, but it's 10:24, and it's time to call it a night for this segment. Once again, want to remind people that if you have any questions and you can't get onto the net, or you like to hear a topic of some kind, or you have a problem or a puzzle that you'd like to share, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. And if you want links to many of the things that were discussed tonight, that's available too. Just go to your browser and type roy.ac2gs.com, and it'll give you links to a couple of the programs that Andy mentioned, and the brick that supercapacitor that Wesley mentioned, and some other things that I think you'll find interesting. And as always, remember that there are archives for everything on the technical net from September 2006 on, thanks to Mike KC2NJI, who has his archive site, amateurradio.tv. So please give a hand for the SpaceNet report with WS2N Paul.
GSWSUN. Very good. And, yeah, this is the space portion of the TechNet. And, of course, it is a TechNet, so if somebody has any technical question and they want to just jump in and just change the subject for a while, that's okay, too. So, just to start off, Ed was talking about Voyager and earlier. And I was telling him 150 hours, and yeah, it's 150 AU, how much astronomical units for Voyager 1. And it's just a little bit checked on the website. It's 150.8. So it's coming close to 151 AU. So, you know, to give you an idea, Pluto was 39. AU astronomical units. Each astronomical unit is the same distance from the Sun to the Earth. So Pluto's 39, and this thing's out past 150. And it's radio communications is, I was guessing 40. Now it's up to 42 hours round trip. And Voyager 2 is a little closer, and Voyager 1 is actually going faster, so it's over the years, it's gotten a little further away. Voyager 2 is 100 and, what did I say? Fine, I wrote it down here. It's a little short, 125, so you got a different, a little different, but they're still both functioning, and Voyager 2 has gotten into the deep space, too. You know, it's gone pretty much past the barrier, the heliopause. Let me drop it. So that's the story in that. They're still both functioning. They both have RTGs on there. Batteries are long gone, but the radioisotope thermoelectric generators are still functioning, providing electricity a lot less than when they started at. They lose around a percent or two every now and then. As the years go by, they had to shut different pieces of equipment down on both spacecraft. But you know, it's still communicating, still pointing in the right direction, and they're doing good, and they're still sending back science on how much plasma or whatever's on the other side of the heliopause. And the heliopause is where the difference between the solar system wind pressure and the galactic wind pressure meets. So they're both in deep space. I was going to start off with the topic that Wesley was talking about before, the Osiris Rex space. Osiris Rex was launched a few years back, roughly 4 years ago, 2016, and it got out to its asteroid Bennu. But it was about a little higher than a skyscraper, and it's roughly like a diamond shape. It's got like four sides to it. It's not a sphere. And it was built and developed by Lockheed. They got the contract for it. You know, usually, sometimes JPL gets it, or APL, Applied Physics Laboratory at Johns Hopkins. This one was built by Lockheed, and so it went out there. It took a couple of years. Spent almost a year trying to get itself into orbit around this thing. It's very hard to put a spacecraft in orbit with such small amount of gravity like Bennu has. And then they had equipment on board, cameras, lasers, radar, and they went through this. They mapped everything down to a couple of centimeters, the whole asteroid, over the last year or so. Surprised when they got there, they thought from the scientific
knowledge that they did have of the asteroid, that it was going to be sandy, like a beach. And they got there, it was extremely rocky. There was rocks all over the place, pebbles and rocks and boulders. And there was PBS program about it on TV recently. If you get a chance to see the Osiris Rex program, though, they show you this sandy beach that they thought it was going to be. So they thought they were going to come down with this 11-foot arm and extend it away from the spacecraft. They were going to fold back the solar panels. Instead of sticking straight out, they were going to fold it back. This way, when it comes down, it won't hit a boulder or something. And they would contact the asteroid with this 11-inch disc. I pretty much talked about this last week. So this 11 or 12-inch diameter thing. It looks like about the size of an old air filter around a car on a V8. And as it touches, and they're not going to stay there because the gravity is so low. As they touch it, they only wanted to stay for 4 seconds or 10 seconds. They were going to stay longer if it was sandy, less if it had a lot of gravel to it. Osiris Rex took about 4 seconds to do what it had to do. They knew where they wanted to go, and sure enough, it worked. And they have these charged gas bottles with some tubing going into this air filter type of gadget that's going to make contact with the surface. And they're nitrogen bottles. I know where Wesley was thinking about argon, but they were nitrogen bottles. They have three of them. So this way it gave them three chances. If the first one they thought didn't do anything, they were going to come down and do it again with the second or even a third. So they had three shots to do it. They did it on the first one. They went down and spent about 4 seconds, and they managed to, the tag unit, it's called the TAG unit. So it goes on the outside, and it pushes up the gravel. And it goes on to the inside, and they have like a check valve system. It's this flap that's there. The stuff goes in, and it's not supposed to come out. So they pulled away from the asteroid like it was supposed to. By the way, this is all done autonomously. This thing's 300 million miles away, and it's not being controlled by mission control and on Earth. So they had set this up, but when it called back and told them what they had, that was with pictures, they knew that it was very good. Now, what their plan was to find out how much weight they had. The idea was to get a couple of grams or anything, they'd be happy if they had a little bit. Turned out they had a lot. Last time we sent their spacecraft to anything was a comet years ago. Back in 1999, they sent Stardust. Stardust went to this comet, built two, and it had this, like they call it a catcher's mitt, but it was this aerogel, very light, fluffy stuff. Collected let's call it the dust from the comet's tail, and they put that catcher's mitt inside of a hermetically sealed unit, and eventually that was sent back to Earth. And when the scientists were able to open it up, they had to use like microscopes to figure out what they had, and they eventually did have something, and so they were able to research what was in the comet by doing that. But this thing, there was another country that did something similar. Japan had Hayabusa and Hayabusa 2. Hayabusa 1 went to a comet and then, you know, came back, and they had all kinds of problems with that for very, very little amount of material, but, you know, they got some stuff back. It was about a little thinner than a human hair. So that worked out, and then they have Hayabusa 2 now that's at another asteroid doing the same thing, but that one didn't come back yet. So what happens with OSIRIS-REx, it looks like they have like 10,000 times the amount of stuff coming back for the scientists to research. That's what they estimate, over 10,000 times the amount. So, and what Wesley was talking about is they took pictures, you know, now floating around in space, they took pictures and to look at the tag, you know, the part that touched the surface, and they see these little particles coming out of the unit. It's not holding in there. The tag unit is designed to hold stuff less than 3/4 inch thick. So that means something got in there around 3/4 inch thick, because it's holding the flap open. So as the spacecraft maneuvers around in space, little pieces are coming out. They don't want that. I mean, the idea is to take this stuff and put it into their hermetically sealed unit and send that back to Earth in 2023. So, you know, they thought they were going to get very little, you know. So the plan was, you know, if nothing was leaking out of this, the plan was to extend this 11-foot arm out and then rotate the spacecraft, start spinning it. They have gyros and things like that. They could spin this easily. The plan from the beginning, before they even launched, was make a collection, extend the arm all the way out, and then rotate the spacecraft. They know that if there was nothing in the arm, they would know the amount of force that was required to turn the spacecraft. If there was anything in the end of the arm, when they started turning the spacecraft into a circle, to spin it up, it would be, they would see it on their telemetry coming back, and they would know exactly how much weight to the gram. I mean, that's how precise this was. They have decided not to do that because they see stuff leaking out of this thing, and they want to bring as much back as possible. They said, that's it, we're going to take it, and we're going to take this air filter light gadget, put it back into the hermetically sealed unit, close it up, and let it sit there until 2023 when it returns with a parachute. By the way, it's going to land in Utah. They have the Army Proving Grounds out in Utah, and that's where they land stuff like this. They've done this type of thing before with, like I said, with Stardust and with another one called Genesis, and that's where things like this wind up. So, we'll wait until 2023 to see what happens with OSIRIS-REx and the information. I mean, you know, they have other equipment on board. There's three different instruments on board. They have the camera set up. OSIRIS-REx has cameras, has lasers, thermal spectrometers, so they know a lot of information already. They have an infrared spectrometer, some kind of X-ray imaging spectrometer, and of course the tag unit. That's the one I've been talking about, the touch and go acquisition mechanism. So when this arm reaches in to put it into this hermetically sealed unit with the heat shield on it, the arm will actually release that round air filter device. The arm pulls back, and then the cover will close and seal itself. That's how that works. Any questions or comments about OSIRIS-REx? This is WS2N.
WS2N, this is M2ZTW. Falling asleep at the helm here, so I'm going to bid you guys all a fond adieu. Hope to speak to you next week. Best regards to all, and 73 NQZTW signing off.
N2, a little noisy this time. I heard it before. N2, something TW, I forgot. I know Roy knows. And very good. 73, nice hearing you, and hope you come back week after week after week. Any questions or comments for tonight?
November 2, Zombie Gone Wild. Good night. 73 to all.
TW at the end. Oh, okay, very good. Any other comments? Okay. And Wesley, are you still listening? I know you were talking about the Osiris Rex before, but are you still out there?
I have a question, W2HO.
Yeah, we lost Wesley. Yeah, okay, W2HO, go ahead.
Yeah, hi, Paul. My name is Howard. And good evening to all. With the spacecraft that landed on the asteroid, I wonder when it's expected to return. Is it expected to return to Earth? And is it going to land in the water, on land? And I just tuned in. I don't know if you already spoke about that. And I also read that there was that they were leaking. Some of the samples were leaking, and they were going to try to fix that. I wonder if that was taken care of.
Very good, Howard. Yeah, we covered it, but I'll go through it again. One more time. No problem. It's coming back in 2023. Naturally, the mother craft will just fly past Earth. But they have a little hermetically sealed entry capsule that will come through with a parachute and land in Utah. They have like a Utah desert out there. The Army proving grounds. So that's what, you know, we got to wait till 2023. And, yeah, their plan was to spin the spacecraft. And by spinning the spacecraft, if there's nothing in it, it would spin at a, you know, a certain rate when it would, you know, torque up the gyros on there, to spin it. You know, a certain amperage would come out. They'd be able to tell exactly, you know, what kind of strength was involved in turning this. You know, if you have a weight on the end, you know, more grams or an ounce or something, it's going to spin more slowly when you try to turn the spacecraft in a circle. And they actually described that very good. If you see the PBS special on OSIRIS-REx, they describe it with, you know, you have these parasites, merry-go-round that you know, a kid would, you know, get on and push himself around. You know, if you push the merry-go-round by itself, it's, you know, you push very lightly. If a kid, one or two kids jump onto it and are sitting there, and then you go to push it, you're going to have to put more strain to spin it up. That type of thing. That's the way they planned on doing it, but it didn't go that way, Howie. So, because of the leaking material, they canceled that project, and they just know that now they have so much stuff, way more than they thought they'd ever get. They're just going to take that arm, put it in, you know, put the disc into the entry capsule, and then close it up, and then the arm pulls away this round tag unit, the touch and go unit will be the only thing that gets returned from that mission. Back to you, Howard.
Okay, I'm calling from my radio. I missed a little bit of that. Thanks for calling, appreciate it, and have a good day. Yes, that's the next thing. I appreciate it. W2HF.
Very good. W2HO. You got a little noise here in that transmission, but I picked it up. I don't know if you were moving around the house with an HD or a mobile or not. You might comment on that, but you were just a little bit more noisy.
Yeah, I'm mobile, and I'm sending calls.
Okay, I heard mobile. Very good. All right, another topic I was going to cover is the Starship that's being built down in Boca Chica, Texas, near Brownsville, Texas, right on the border of Mexico and the U.S. And they have SpaceX is creating the Starship, which will eventually be their vehicle. His ultimate goal is to send it to Mars, but he might eventually use it to orbit the moon, eventually land on the moon. But this is a massive vehicle. It's going to be, as big as, if not bigger, a little bit bigger than the Saturn V rocket that we built to go to the moon. But it's in the early stages yet. He's still building the Starship itself, and he's not finished testing out a booster yet. But the Starship is pretty impressive as it is. It's roughly around almost 200 feet tall. When it's completely assembled, it's going to have six Raptor engines in the Starship. And Raptor engines are powerful engines that he's built. Each one has 450,000 pounds of thrust, and eventually have six in this whole Starship. And essentially, it's the second stage with the crew and everything, and this whole piece will eventually come back. The ultimate design would be to take this whole setup and put this way up on top of another booster. So you have this roughly 170-foot Starship sitting on top of a couple hundred foot, over a couple hundred feet booster, totaling 400 feet. In the booster, instead of just six of these engines, he plans on putting 27 or 28. He started off with 34, but he's worked it down to around 27 or 28. He's been able to get more thrust out of these Raptor engines than he originally wanted to do. So SpaceX is, developing this, coming along pretty good. Last year, a little over a year ago, they launched the grass, it was, they call it the Starhopper, and it was one engine, one 450,000 pound engine, lifting this one, essentially a flying tank with four big legs on it, and it flew up and flew over and came back down and landed. This thing was it went up around 500 feet. And then came back down and landed in another spot a few hundred feet from where it took off. So then eventually, he finished up with that test. Now he's actually making the Starship itself. And he started off testing that with just one engine as well, except it's much bigger. This thing, it looks like a big, tall silo. And it's got liquid oxygen and liquid methane as a fuel. Launched that with one engine. And it went over around 500 feet in the air and came back down and landed. He did that with that, and he had another version. He numbers these things. The one that just that flew the first time was the SN6, the SN5. They're still operable, but they're not going to use them anymore. They're sitting in the facility. But he keeps building more of these things. Now he's up to SN8. Got this thing now on the launch pad. Instead of one engine, he's going to put three engines in. Ultimately, he plans on putting six engines in. Three that work with atmosphere on Earth, 14.7 pounds per square inch, and then another three. They're called vacuum engines. They're made to operate in a vacuum, and they're all Raptor engines. You know, except you're going to get a lot more thrust out of the ones in a vacuum than you will on the ones on Earth. But right now, he wants to do three. He's never done three before. He's just used one. And I think within a week or so, he's going to be ready to test this thing. Instead of going up 500 feet, he plans on going up 50,000 feet. So higher than, you know, when you're flying an airplane, higher than that. What's an airplane? I think 35,000 feet or something. So he plans on getting up to around 50,000 feet and seeing if he could tilt this thing down and let it come down on its belly all the way back to the launch facility. To do that, he's got these wings. He's got wings in the back, that two big wings that are going to be adjustable. They'll be able to move. And he's also got two leading wings up on the nose. He's got a conical nose. Electric motors are run on batteries. He's got lithium batteries. So what kind of batteries does he have? He builds these Tesla cars. So he's taking the batteries out of the Tesla cars, you know, from that design, and he's putting them into this rocket. So, I'd like to see this thing. It's going to come back, and it's going to get very close to the landing pad, and probably the last 30 seconds or so, these first nitrogen engines will fire to push things, start pushing this thing upright, you know, vertical. And then the Raptor engine, probably one Raptor engine, maybe three, I'm not sure, will reignite and then straighten itself out and come back down vertically and land on a pad. That's his goal. If that doesn't work, if it crashes, he's got more of these things. I think he's up to 14. He keeps building one right after the other. This one is SN8. He plans on doing 9, 10, 11. He's already up to 14. He's in the process of developing these things. These are all stainless steel rockets. And, it's a different way of thinking. NASA, builds and tests and builds and tests each little piece, and then eventually they put it together and hope it works. This guy kind of like puts everything together, launches, if it crashes, who cares, build another one, and off you go. Learn as you go. And that's the way he's doing it. Any questions on the Starship development? This is WS2M. Okay, one thing I wanted to mention before, next week anyway, NASA's supposed to make an announcement about some kind of discovery about the moon. And this announcement is supposed to come out tomorrow. And somehow it has to do with the SOFIA mission. SOFIA is the they've got this telescope mounted in a 747, and SOFIA is an acronym for Stratospheric Observatory for Infrared Astronomy. And this thing has this, this 9-foot-long telescope in the back of the 747. They've got this big hole cut in the side of the plane. And, you can see this 8-foot diameter. Dish sticking out, and it works on infrared, and they have a control center inside the plane. This thing flies up to 45,000 feet, and they use it for astronomical observing. So apparently this has something to do with the moon, and it's something to do with this plane, and that's getting weird. They used to just tell you you know, what's going on, no big secret. And now it's like a, I don't know, it's weird. It's like a, some kind of reality show. Tune in next week, and now I got to tune in tomorrow to find out what the answer is. So I will find out what the answer is and what the big discovery about the moon is. And I don't have any guesses, but my guess has something to do with infrared astronomy. But I'll find out what it is, and I'll let you know next week on the net. Any questions or comments? WS2N. So we'll wait to find out what that's all about. The crew on the International Space Station right now is just three people, two Russians and Dr. Kate Rubin from NASA are up there, and they've been looking for a leak. They've been just launching. They're up there like a couple of weeks already. So one of the things that they're doing is they're looking for this leak for last year. So different crews have been involved, and they can't find this air leak. You know, where's the air going? So over the year, they've managed to, you know, they would close different doors. You know, there's module after module, and they would close different doors, see if there's any kind of pressure drop over time. And it's such a small leak, it takes days. So sometimes they'll have to leave a module or two closed for a couple of days just to take a reading. So finally, recently, they did track it back down to the Zvezda module. Zvezda unit is the Russian main module. That's where the Russian crew sleeps. That's where the Russian crew eats. And they have the they have tanks attached to it with rocket little, you know, they can move the space station if they have to. They might want to raise it to a higher orbit because over time the orbit decays. And, you know, that's connected to the Zarya module, which is another module, and then that's attached to the Unity module, which is developed by the United States, and then it keeps going all the way down the line. You have Discovery, and then another module called Harmony, and another, you know, just one after the other. So they managed to find out that's coming from the Russian one. So I don't know who came up with the idea. Probably the Russians. They've had all kinds of test equipment going up there, ultrasonic things, they're listening through their, you know, through earphones, trying to listen for a leak. And nothing worked out. So what they did this time is they took a bunch of dried up tea leaves. You know, they had Russian tests of tea. They took dried up tea leaves, opened it up, and let it float in midair. And then
that time
they left the module, closed the module off. They have video cameras, and they're able to watch it. And they watch where these little tea leaves floated to, and eventually floated to the side of the cabin. And sure enough, got very close to where one of the communication pieces of equipment are. You know, and sure enough, behind that is apparently they must have found this hairline crack. So they got to find a way to permanently seal it, because what's been happening, it's been getting worse over the year. So, you know, that's something they're definitely going to have to fix. But they temporarily fix it anyway. They have Kevlar tape, Captain tape on board. You know, something you would use, use for electronic circuits, whatever, to try to keep heat away. It's got a tremendous heat capability, I think a 500 degree range or something. So they use that to temporarily seal the seal it, put tape on the airline crack.